This is The New Criterion. I'm James Panero, Executive Editor. In a few moments, we will join Peter Vertasnik as he reads from The Nature of Things Fragile, his new collection that is the winner of the 23rd New Criterion Poetry Prize, now out from Criterion Books. But, as we now do each year, let's first check in with Adam Kirsch, the New Criterion's Poetry Editor. Adam, welcome.
Hello.
Adam is one of the judges of the New Criterion Prize. He also puts together the special poetry section for our April 2024 issue, Poets. If you would like Adam to consider your work for the 24th Poetry Prize, with an award of $3,000 and the publication of your winning manuscript, the window for submissions is now open until May 15. To learn more, go to newcriterion.com/poetryprize. But on to the April issue. Adam, please take us through it, beginning with William Logan's lead feature called Among the Missing, Among the Dead, Black Poetry in America.
Well, we're excited about the April issue every year. I am, because it's the annual poetry issue. So in addition to some special poems and often translations, we have a set of essays about different aspects of poetry. And there's always a variety of things. So it's always interesting to see what people are interested in writing about. This year we have, leading off the issue, William Logan, who's the New Criterion's poetry critic and writes the Verse Chronicle, has written an essay about black poetry really from after the Civil War until the period of the Harlem Renaissance. And he goes through some of the better known and lesser known black poets of the period and talks about what were the stylistic issues, as well as the sort of social and historical issues that they were interested in that animated their work. It's a very informative survey of some poets that I think were once better known than they now are in a lot of cases. Moving on, we have Ahmet Majmadar, who is himself a poet and contributing poetry to the New Criterion, as does William Logan, in fact, with an essay on the 400th anniversary of the publication of Shakespeare's First Folio. And in looking at the First Folio, Ahmet Majmadar is looking at Shakespeare's words, focusing on Shakespeare's language and what it is about his language that makes him so appealing, particularly to poets in generation after generation, why they learn from him and imitate him, and the sort of amazing freedom he had, including all the new words that he coined.
A beautiful essay and quite personal, too.
It is. He talks about how when he was a 17-year-old poet, some of the first things he wrote were sort of imitations of Shakespeare, and that for a while that he thought they were the best things he wrote because he had sort of been inspired. Mm-hmm. Less known than Shakespeare in America, certainly, is Ingeborg Bachmann, who is a 20th century Austrian poet. She was very prominent in German language poetry after World War II, and her poetry was edited, and her biographer is Peter Filkins. We have an essay by Peter Filkins sort of introducing Ingeborg Bachmann. The title of this is The Unspeakable Spoken, and it's about how she helped after World War II to sort of regenerate German poetry and German literature by confronting the experience that the country had had during World War II and blending old and new poetic styles. She herself went through a long period of silence. She became very well known as a poet early in her life and then stopped writing poetry and turned to other kinds of writing before publishing more work, I think, after her death. And so she has an interesting biographical story as well. Then Katie Hartsock, another very good poet whose verse has appeared in the New Criterion, has written an essay called The Old and the New about what she calls revisioning the classics. She says, revisionist, when applied to old things, old literature often means something political. When she talks about revisionary poetry, she says she's not talking about that necessarily, but about contemporary writers who revision ancient Greek myths and stories. And in fact, she points out that this is something that's been going on ever since Roman times. Ovid is one of the first people she writes about. Ovid sort of took up stories from the Iliad and retold them, and she shows how poets are continuing to do that today.
She finishes that essay by saying, quote, "So I do not worry when I hear chatter of disrupting or canceling the classics, since they have survived this long by having been disrupted, changed, and saved by those who will continue to change and save like no one else poets. Do you agree with that?
I think it's true, yes. I mean, one thing that she brings out very well is that in age after age, and very much including our own, people are very drawn to these ancient Greek myths, even though you could say that they no longer have the currency or the prestige that they once did for educated people, you know, 200 years ago, when absolutely everyone who had an education was educated in Greek myths. There's something about these stories that draws poets to them. A good example might be Louise Glück, who won the Nobel Prize a couple of years ago, but lots of different poets as well. And again, she talks about what it is about these stories that makes them so open and available to being retold in different ways. And then finally, the last essay is something quite unusual. It's less a critical essay than you might even call it a kind of prose poem. It's by a French writer named Pascal Quignard, who is a novelist, and he has written a what he calls an answer to Lord Chandos. Now, this is a sort of text that's responding to another text. 100 years ago or more, even, the Austrian poet Hugo von Hofmannsthal wrote a letter in the voice of a fictional character called Lord Chandos to Francis Bacon, who was a real person, set in the 17th century, in which he talked about how he felt that he had come to the end of literature, to the end of writing, and all he had in him was silence. And so in this answer to Lord Chandos, Quignard, who is writing today, sort of says silence is not an answer. Human beings will never be able to be content being silent. And he talks about what it is about poetry and literature that makes people always be drawn back to them, even when they think they've come to the end. And it's a very rich kind of language. And as I said, sort of a prose poem in and of itself.
Yeah, I had to read the introduction to it a few times before I finally digested it.
Right.
And tell us a bit about this writer.
He is a French novelist. He's best known for writing novels, some of which were turned into movies, French movies. But this is a text that he wrote in the 1970s that has now, for the first time, been translated and is being published in book form. What we have here is an excerpt from it.
Mm, right. And then moving on to the poems.
Right. So for the poetry issue, we often have new translations of classic poems. And that's what we have this year. We have three different poems, or poets, I should say, represented. Two of them are European. One is Goethe, whose poem Prometheus is translated by Frederick Amrein and Patrick Whelan. Prometheus is a poem about, the Greek mythological figure Prometheus, so it fits in very nicely with Katie Hartsock's essay, and imagines him sort of defying the gods. We have a poem from Leopardi, the great romantic Italian poet, translated by Beverly B. Brahek, who has translated a few Leopardi poems for us in the past and does a beautiful job with it. And then we have translations by Ryan Choi, whose work has also been featured in past issues of the New Criterion, of a Japanese poet named Natsumi Soseki. Three poems by him, some of which are untitled, but deal with sort of classic themes of setting out on a journey or reassessing one's life in a way that seems both classic and modern. These are poems written around the turn of the 20th century.
Yeah, I like having these translations as part of the poetry issue. Are they hard to collect? How do you find them?
You know, I think that there are poets who are at work on translations who are only too happy to have some place to have people read them. So the real challenge is just finding the right people. And I think these are all people who have found their way to us, or we have found our way to them, because we're really on the same wavelength.
Yeah, great. Well, guests are gathering outside my office door for the Poetry Prize celebration. Please tell us something about this winning collection.
The Nature of Things Fragile is this year's New Criterion Poetry Prize winner. The Poetry Prize, we say, is for poems that pay attention to form. So they don't have to be strictly formal. But in this case, we have a poet who does use a lot of traditional forms and meters, including sestinas and a lot of iambic pentameter, to make really personal, I think, very open and vulnerable statements about things like childhood and illness and growing up, sort of universal themes, but in a very contemporary, very accessible language, not at all removed or antiquated. And I think he does something that the best poets today, certainly the ones that we try to publish in the New Criterion, do, which is show that these traditional forms can be used today just as they were in the past to communicate really important things.
Well, Adam, thank you as always. Now let's turn to Peter Vertasnik as he reads from The Nature of Things Fragile, starting with your introduction.
That's right.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Hey, it's great to be here. All right, I'll probably read, I don't know, 4 or 5 poems. 2 of them are quite short, though. So, this first one, probably one of the oldest poems in the collection. It's a Shakespearean sonnet called Visiting Hours. That evening, while her loved one sat beside the bed, it seemed she might be getting well. Even when her boy fidgeted and cried, she felt calm, lulled by his familiar smell, as by her husband's voice when he recounted his day, a haircut, work, the grocery store. Both sense and tenor gradually surmounted the fear that she should never hope for more than intermittent health. No regimen or drug the doctors ordered could relieve the pain her family had quelled again by visiting, though soon they'd have to leave. Then she would wait alone for sleep, a guest who seldom came, or coming brought no rest. Yes, there's, if you read in certain sections of this book, there are a lot of depressing, can I say that? It's a lot of, so I've tried to mitigate the potentially depressing effect by reading across sections of the book. Not that depressing poems aren't great poems, we all love a good depressing poem. These next two poems are short, they're epigrams, and the epigram to me seems like one of these traditions that's constantly in danger of disappearing, but in any given time there's always one or two practitioners out there, not claiming that I'm one of those great practitioners, but here are a couple epigrams. This one is called Dial Tone, and it's a monorhyme. Seems strange to miss this barren baritone, once known to all, and by all overthrown. To miss, whenever I pick up my phone and make a call, the barely noticed drone that spoke of reaching out, of being alone. And a friend of mine, who's a musician, recently told me that she didn't think that the dial tone as we know it was actually a baritone, but I'm going to conveniently ignore that for tonight. Here's another epigrammatic poem about living out in West Texas. It's called Wind, Lubbock, Texas. Sharpened vacancy, shifting angled sting, smelling of dust or rain, ubiquitous, arcane, carries debris like a tune in some gritty minor key. The horizon, brown as a dune, hums but does not sing. So I grew up in Michigan, in Saginaw, Michigan, actually, Theodore Recchi's hometown. And there's this little two-lane highway that connects Saginaw to a small town not far from Lansing, and when you drive past it, M13 it's called, in the winter time, right at the end of the fall, if you're lucky, you can see all the sugar beets that have been harvested. Sugar beets. This, by the way, the form of this is word counts, which is a form that I picked up from Robert Francis, and it simply just counts the number of words in a line rather than the number of syllables or number of stresses. Here, I cheat a little bit because I have word particles that are hyphenated, but I count them all as one. So it's 3 words or word particles to a line here. Sugar beets. Driving the narrow 2-lane between Saginaw and Lennon in late autumn, past fields frozen in harvest furrows, the road treated against the evening's forecast of sleet, rock salt rattling like gravel in the wheel wells. I see, on my left, beneath tall stadium lights, the beat receiving station. Last week, an empty lot, where now jagged pyramids, Aztec or Incan, rise darkly to stunted summits. piled bodies gnarled and cratered, still caked with clods and root hairs, concealing latent sweetness, soon to disappear again, refine into masses of granules, equally as anonymous as those places that changed them. Croswell and Caro, Bay City, Sibley. And the last poem that I'll read is it's one of three cemetery poems in the book, so back to depressing. But this was a result of many of us, I think, were finding ways to get exercise during the pandemic when we're kind of cooped up, and I happened to be living in a place at the time that was across the street from two cemeteries, which gave me ample time to walk and kind of think. This one's called The Fenced Field. A dark mound lists and settles, reclaimed by teething grass. Below, the last wait has begun, that interval between root and rooted. In death, as in life, we have made things difficult. Your remains remain preserved and sealed. How long before the anchored cedar knocks and gnaws at the hull of the concrete vault? How soon until the groundwater gains purchase, then entrance? The slow pulse of the soil will crack in casement and gasket. This muffled rupture, the one sure rapture. Beneath the surface, every surface will be opened and dispersed by the earth's digesting undertow. Thank you.